Please pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, for you are our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. I don't know if I'll ever forget the last time my mother planned and hosted a family reunion. It had been several years since the last reunion on her side of the family, mainly due to the fact that one of her brothers and her nephew couldn't agree on who would host the event, even though they insisted that it had to be one of them. My mother waited patiently for them to decide, but after 3 years with no reunion, she gave up and decided to host it herself. After sending out invitations to everyone for whom she had an address, my mother decided she wanted to open the event to other distant relatives who might not be known to the rest of the family. In order to reach them, she placed an advertisement in the local newspaper inviting those who were related to her grandparents and her great-grandparents to attend the event. A few days before the event, my mother's nephew and brother, who had been struggling over who would host the event, decided that they weren't going to attend, leaving my mother somewhat heartbroken. But she wasn't willing to give up, as she knew her sister and her other brother would attend along with several cousins. The day of the reunion turned out to be a beautiful, crisp Saturday in early October, and we rose early, my sister and I, to help Mom finish the cooking for the reunion. There was baked ham and home-cooked green beans from our garden and mashed potatoes, again fresh from our garden, and my mom's famous macaroni and cheese, homemade yeast rolls, more salads than I can remember, as well as lemon pound cake and apple pie made from my grandmother's recipes. It was a feast like what we had at Christmas and Easter. And the guests began to arrive finally around 11 o'clock. My aunt Jean and Uncle Don were the first. They brought homemade slaw and potato salad and wilted lettuce. And my aunt Pat and Uncle Jim arrived next, and they brought with them a homemade yellow cake with chocolate icing, another of my grandmother's traditions. Several cousins arrived as we neared lunch and brought with them even more food. Needless to say, there was more food than could have been eaten in a week, much less a day, but my family has always had a conviction that there should be more than enough food so that no matter how many guests, there will always be enough for everyone with leftovers. Toward noon, several more cars arrived and parked along the driveway. But the folks who got out were strangers to me. When they came in the door, my mother welcomed them and invited them into the den where the rest of the family was gathered and laughing as they were retelling stories from their childhood. Our guests introduced themselves as Mary and Thomas Marsh. They had seen the advertisement in the newspaper and wanted to meet their long-lost family. Now, Thomas and Mary were welcomed with open arms and laughed as much as the rest of us as the stories continued to flow. There was only one problem. As the day went on, no one could seem to figure out how these Marshes were related to our Marshes. They remembered a Catherine Marsh who lived in southwestern Virginia, who was Thomas's great aunt, but they couldn't remember exactly where she lived, only that it was in the mountains. The problem was that my grandmother's given name was Kate, not Catherine. As the hours went on, though, it became clear that Thomas and Mary, if they were related, were distant relatives long since removed from our immediate family line. It would have been easy at that point for Mary and Thomas to get up and leave when they discovered that there was no direct connection with our family, but they didn't. It would also have been easy for the members of my family to ask the couple to leave when it became clear that they weren't the long-lost relatives at first we had hoped, but they didn't. Instead, the couple stayed and enjoyed the day with our family. They helped us eat that 25-pound ham that my mother had baked and all of those fabulous side dishes that she and her family had prepared. We laughed, We cried. We became family that day. My mother and Mary did eventually discover that they were distantly related, though removed by several generations, but only after some years beyond that family reunion. They stayed in touch for the rest of their lives and became close friends, something that they might have missed if the rule of hospitality hadn't overturned the rule of family that day. Have you ever experienced one of those encounters that shouldn't have happened, but through which your life was blessed by being open to complete strangers? In Judaism, there's an ancient tradition of leaving an open, prepared seat for the prophet Elijah at the table, at every meal. The practice began as a way of being ready to welcome the prophet who might return at any moment, but it has come to symbolize the importance of hospitality in Judaism. The prophet, a messenger of God, might return at any moment in any person, and thus there should always be an open space at the table as a way of welcoming any and all who might arrive. The thing that gets Jesus in trouble, far more than anything else in the Gospels, is eating with the wrong people. The average person saw Jesus as a prophet, a teacher, a leader who offered hope in the midst of the crushing oppression of Rome and the complicity of the religious and political leaders of the day. These same religious and political leaders saw Jesus as a threat. Unlike those with prosperity, power, position, and privilege, Jesus did not withdraw from the masses. He embraced them, and they embraced him. If he had wanted to earn the favor of Rome and the respect of the religious leaders who controlled the temple, Jesus could have courted them. He would have reached out to them and offered them some support for their way of life, but he didn't. He didn't reject them, but Jesus certainly didn't approve of their way of life. He sought out instead those who were left to fend for themselves, the women, those who were ill, those who were poor, those who were young, those who were considered outcasts in his day. The religious and political leaders saw this not only as a rejection of their way of life, but as a threat to their very place in society. If those who were reviled by the elite were to be embraced, they might begin to think that they had a right to live and to speak and to decide, something that those in power were not willing to concede. Today's gospel reading clearly illustrates Jesus' concern for those on the margins of society. But it comes with a harder edge than we're used to hearing from Jesus. The story comes in the midst of an extended interaction with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, during which Jesus continues to challenge these religious leaders to be open to the ways in which God is still active in the world. They had drawn very clear lines around the temple, pointedly identifying those who were considered worthy to enter its gates and receive its ministries, but Jesus refused to respect those boundaries. He reminds them in story after story that God remains unimpressed by their understanding of righteousness based on societal identity. Jesus says that the reign of heaven can be compared to a ruler who decided to throw a great wedding banquet, a joyful feast for a beloved child. The ruler and the royal household were busy for weeks with preparations, ensuring that everything is perfect to provide for a celebration that would last for days. When the final piece is in place, when the table is set and the food is ready to be served, the ruler sends servants out to usher the invited guests into the hall. But each guest offers regrets, providing excuse after excuse for not attending the feast. They dismiss the invitation without so much as a second thought. An amazing act in an era when few other than the wealthiest elite had enough to eat, and these parties were looked at as joyful occasions to celebrate and fill yourself for the first time in many months, if not years. Some of the guests even go so far as to beat and kill the servants sent to take them in to the celebration. If this sounds ludicrous, it's meant to sound that way. This banquet represents the great feast in the fullness of God's reign, the one to which Isaiah points in our first reading today, the incredible celebration of the healing of the world and everyone having enough. Who would turn down such an invitation? The ruler is enraged at the rejection of hospitality and the treatment of the servants. And the ruler sends armed guards to punish those who beat and killed the servants and sent other servants into the street to invite all whom they find who are willing to come to the feast. It doesn't matter whether the person is poor or wealthy, whether the person is a citizen or a foreigner, a slave or free, the circumstances of life are unimportant. There is a celebration to enjoy, and one and all are welcome. The most surprising aspect of this story, though, is the last one. Once the hall is filled with guests celebrating the wedding of the ruler's child, a person is found to be improperly dressed. Now, while it may seem odd to us that a celebration attended by anyone and everyone from the streets could have a strict dress code, we have to keep in mind that weddings were serious events in that time. Certain forms of dress were expected, and they were most often provided by the host to ensure everyone's participation. This guest had the chance to put on a robe at the door, but refused. This guest, like the first guests, refuses to acknowledge the authority and the generosity of the host. And so the guest is taken from the hall by guards and thrown into prison. Now, it's important for us to remember this is a parable. This isn't a factual story, but a story told to teach a lesson. The feast represents the reign of God. And the first guests represent the religious leaders of the day, and the second guests represent the rest of humanity. The guest who refused to wear a wedding robe represents those welcomed into the fullness of God's presence, who refuse to honor the host and to respect the other guests. But what does this mean for all of us? We live in a world that has been described as an age of narcissism, where concern for self seems to overrule all other concerns in life. This story reminds us that we are all guests invited to the great feast of God, and that we are all subject to the one who has made us and entrusted the world to our care. We can demand to have things our way right away, or we can choose to live with a sense of appreciation for being invited to the feast in the first place. We can choose to wear gratitude instead of want. Paul reminds us to do just that by focusing on what is honorable and pure and pleasing and commendable. He invites us to consider our blessings and to offer praise to God. For such thoughts will keep us rooted in the love of God. All of these stories that Jesus tells in this section of Matthew have one unifying theme: humility. When so many are in need in this world, none of us has the right to demand our ease and comfort. We are all utterly dependent upon the mercy of God and the compassion of each other to survive. To live with an awareness of that truth is to be properly attired for the great feast to which all of humanity is invited. Amen.